This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
In a dark time, when hope was bleak, there lived a young girl whose only escape was in a legend that wanted her back.
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today we're looking at 2006 dark fantasy, Pan's Labyrinth, or El Laberinto del Fauno, as it was called in the original Spanish. Guillermo del Toro's kind of, I think it was really his first like massive international hit, or was this after Hellboy?
This is after Hellboy, but this is like his, considered his masterpiece, I would say.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, his Pièce de Résistance.
Si.
Seminal work.
Oui.
So we'll go over some news first, tell you a little bit about our thoughts about the movie. There's some trivia, and then we'll get stuck in to some of the science, including why it's not a great idea to have eyes on your hands. Some stuff about exploding animals and toads, and then we might touch on fairies a little bit and the whole concept of fairies at the end as well. As always, the show's broken up into a few different segments, but we'll have time codes below, so skip ahead to whatever bit you're looking forward to. Before we get started, my name's Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater / invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside host Adam Hasek, who is a disease / parasite ecologist, currently based at the University of Arkansas, on his way to the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in, what you said, October, right?
Yep, so October.
5 months. Fucking hell. Big, big change. 4 months. 10 minus 6 is 4, Sam.
Oh, no. So soon.
Alongside Adam is Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as a brief, we're joined by Dave, our friend who is a vet and a movie physiologist. So, news this week, because we're talking about a massive toad. I thought it was kind of hilarious that earlier this week, Norway made it illegal to relocate frog spawn from one body of water to another. And
interesting.
They've done this because, yeah, it seems stupid, but they've done it because there's lots of fungal diseases in amphibians up in this part of Europe.
Not stupid at all.
Yeah, so what they've tried to do is prevent people taking frogs that may have this disease and spreading it into new ponds and waterways. But of course, you know, because it's a law and it's somewhat environmental, there are some right-wing politicians here who have lost their mind about something they never even would have thought of otherwise.
Or understand, I'm sure.
We're probably still don't understand.
Yeah. I think it's really hilarious that all of a sudden these people who were just like, who would never ever think about, you know, even touching frog spawn are just like, well, you've taken away my right to move tadpoles into another body of water. I mean, I never would have done this, but I want to at least be able to do it, you know?
Yeah, that disease, it's called chytrid. It's from a fungus that has been devastating reptile and amphibian populations worldwide. And I didn't realize it was in Norway, but it's a huge problem here in North America right now. And bullfrogs in particular are known for being a pretty problematic vector for it because they're really big and they move around a lot and they bring it from one body of water to another. So not moving frog spawn is a pretty good move.
Yeah. And, I mean, amphibians the whole world over are doing really badly because they're incredibly sensitive to like chemical changes in the water and that sort of stuff. And they are one of the groups of animals. So it's really difficult for us to say what climate change is going to do to a lot of birds and mammal species. But we're pretty sure it's going to have a serious negative effect on amphibians.
Yeah, there was a recent paper in Science, a meta-analysis looking at the effects of temperature change on amphibians. And what they found was that unseasonably hot or unseasonably cool days really, really fucked up the amphibians more than a normal weather day did. So, as Sam was saying, we're worried it's going to be really bad for them, and it is going to be really bad for them.
Slime beneath me, slime up above. Toxic love.
Pan's Labyrinth, or like I said, as Guillermo del Toro prefers to be called, I guess the Fort Labyrinth of the Fawn.
The Fawn's Labyrinth, yeah.
Fawn's Labyrinth, yeah. We'll get into a little bit about that later on. It's essentially the story of Ophelia, a girl who was sent to live on a farmhouse in the countryside with her mother's new husband, who is a Francoist in the army.
A fascist.
For those of you who don't know who Franco is, yeah, Franco was Spain's version of Hitler. And she finds out, I'm doing quotation marks, and we'll talk about this later, that she is the reincarnation of a lost fairy princess, and she's visited by a fawn and given three tasks to complete before she can return to the Lost Kingdom. And she has to complete these tasks whilst the world around her is going to shit, basically. Her mother is in having a really difficult pregnancy, and her new stepfather is a total fuckwit, very much the villain of the piece. He's trying to hunt down a group of rebels in the local forest and doing a really fucking brutal job of it. So, yeah, what do we all like about this movie?
The acting is superb. Sergei Lopez, he plays Captain Vidal. He was wonderful. Super captivating, super intimidating, super scary. And okay. I didn't really dislike much of it.
Libby, you were the one who chose this. Why is this...
Yeah.
Why was this your choice?
This has long been, I think, for me, one of my top five favorite movies of all time. and I think the reason I like this movie is because it is sort of like a storyteller's paradise, if you will. Like, the way that he encapsulates fairy tales and modernizes it to 1944, but modernizes it to to blend it with reality and history and interwoven themes throughout the entire movie. As I was telling Adam last night, I feel like this movie does such a fantastic job of not having a single puzzle piece out of place. Like, it all blends together so beautifully. And one of my absolute top favorite soundtracks of all time.
I love the war side of the story. I think it's a really cool depiction of... Because, I mean, again, the Nazis are in a film a lot. The Francoist regime gets looked over. People don't realize that there was another version of Hitler operating in Europe at the exact same time. As Adam said, Sergei Lopez, I think, is fantastic. Doug Jones is incredible, and we've got some trivia on him later in this. And, I mean, when you have a film that rests on a kid, you have to get a good child actor. I think Ivana Baquero does an amazing job.
I love the creature design. I mean, I was so happy when we chose this, because just the stuff that comes out of his head between this, between Hellboy, between some of the other films we've talked about of his in the past.
Oh, okay, the stuff that comes out of his head. I thought you were talking about the horns. I thought you were being very literal.
Del Toro's head. In terms of the creatures that are created, I mean, we'll get into them today, but they all just look fantastic on a rewatch yesterday. Like, the practical special effects look great, and the costume design. I mean, the fawn alone, just every time it's walking around and moving, that first scene where we run into it, where it moves its way out of the wall. Man, that's cool.
Yeah. Does anybody have anything they don't like about this movie?
I think some of the CGI didn't hold up.
The frog looks a bit.
A little bit, but it wasn't too bad.
I actually find that the fantasy part drags a bit for me. Like I said, I really like the wartime stuff, but I do find the fantasy bit is a... Yeah, but it could also be I have no connection to this sort of these stories at all.
Right. The only thing that even on a rewatch, but I was much more understanding of it this time, is the housekeeper when she finds herself caught by the evil guy and he's setting up to torture.
Mercedes?
Yes. And she stabs him like 7 times, but then... for some reason doesn't finish the job. I was like, but I get it, that she's scared, like, on a rewatch. The first time I watched it, I was like, just stab him. Which I think is, obviously, with no experience in violence or assault at all, I'm just like, oh, why don't you just, like, stab him in the face again? But I, understanding on a second watch, I'm like, yeah, she's terrified, and she's just moving away as quickly as she possibly can from this guy that nearly tortured her to death.
Yeah, I think that's really well represented, too, by the fact that she stabs him, and one of those is, like, straight in the arm. It's like, she's just like, anywhere, I don't care, I'm leaving, bye. Yeah.
Until she fish lips him, which is such a great scene.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the other thing I was going to say that I love about this movie is, well before it was kind of popularized, not that that's a bad thing by any means,
Before it was cool, just so you know.
It is a very pro-feminist movie to me, between Ophelia and Mercedes, and even a little bit the mother. They just have a lot of heroines, which is really nice to see.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you, get you, get you, get you.
Okay, so when it comes to trivia, the thing that I've always found incredible about this film is that, and I know this is a mainly Spanish-speaking cast, and I'm picking out the one English-speaking guy, but Doug Jones's effort to do this, he learned all the lines in Spanish phonetically, despite the fact that he did not know a word of Spanish beforehand. They did end up dubbing over him anyway, with Pablo Adán, who's the narrator. But that was made so much easier because Doug Jones already had all the lip movements down, and he could just dub over him. I mean, obviously, you still have to sync up your voice, but yeah, I think that is absolutely incredible.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it blew my mind because Doug Jones is incredible. I mean, Guillermo del Toro loves him, and you know, for good reason. His physicality is incredible.
He's a weird looking dude.
Yeah, he's a weird looking dude. I doubt that, you know, Sally Hawkins would have wanted to fuck any other fishman if that fishman wasn't played by Doug Jones.
I mean, some would say that's still problematic and weird, but, you know, that's just me. Yeah.
No, I am completely on your side there, Adam. The other thing, we've talked about ambiguous endings a lot, really. Guillermo del Toro has said that he stands by the fantasy being real, so that she actually does become reincarnated. However, as with a few films I've seen recently, he said, but it's up to people to interpret however they want. You are free to take it as you would. On rewatching the second time, I was like, yeah, okay, that's nice that the fantasy is real. But my sort of more realistic brain was like, no, of course she died. This isn't real. This is silly.
I read an interview with him, and he said that he designed the plot to be a Rorschach test of sorts. So if you go into the movie thinking that it's all in her head, then by the end of the movie, you will confirm that bias, like that you'll say, like, yeah, it was all in her head. And you know, the opposite is true. Like, if you go into the movie thinking the fantasy is real, then by the end, you're like, yep, there's proof that it's real.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And he has actually, he said that there's a lot of other stuff that's open to interpretation as well. Like, he said the pale man, for instance, could just be the fawn in a different disguise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just testing her. Yeah. He does eat that fairy, though. So, those two fairies.
They're very similar looking mouths.
And, Libby, you were saying before that Guillermo del Toro hated that this was called Pan's Labyrinth, right?
Yeah, because Pan is a Greek god, and this has nothing to do with Pan at all.
A very mischievous Greek god.
Yeah, so whenever it was translated into English, that's what they went with, because they felt like Americans wouldn't know what a faun was.
Do Americans, like, know who Pan was?
No.
Well, I mean, I think in defense of that, from my understanding of Greek mythology, what the faun is a satyr. It's a humanoid torso with goat legs and horns. But a faun is like a goat upper body with human legs.
But this thing had goat legs, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and goat horns. It's not quite.
I mean, not like furry, like hairy goat legs with hooves. Does he have hooves? I didn't really see.
He has
hooves.
He's got hooves.
He's got weird backwards legs, yeah. And goat eyes.
Yeah.
It does bear resemblance to Pan, and I guess in defense of, I kind of like Pan's Labyrinth better than Faun's Labyrinth. It kind of rolls off the tongue a little better.
What about David Bowie's Labyrinth?
That's just amazing. No. That's just you can't beat that. So don't try.
Dance, magic, dance.
You remind me of the babe. Babe with the power.
What power?
Power of voodoo.
You do.
They're
what?
Remind me of the babe.
It sounds like very mystical, like the Labyrinth of the Faun. That works pretty well.
Yeah.
Because that's the literal translation.
But it is this thing of, and Dave, I think we talked about this when we talked about Jurassic Park. Like, does Jurassic Park sound cool because of, you know, Jurassic Park being Jurassic Park? Or does Jurassic Park just sound intrinsically cooler anyway?
I think the Labyrinth of the Faun is fine. I mean, to me, that kind of almost sounds more like a horror movie. You know, like the Labyrinth of the Faun.
Labyrinth of the Faun. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Do you think this strays into horror at any point?
Yes. Yeah, I think it blends fantasy and horror together. Because if you note, like, the creatures, you know, the entire movie, she's escaping this horrible situation that's around her. And that is horrific. But then the fantasy side isn't beautiful. Like, the faun is fucking creepy as shit. Like, you know? you know, even the fairies are not pretty fairies. Like, they're little pointy-eared, pointy-teeth, like, kind of creepy little...
Bald little elf fuckers. Demons.
Yeah.
Like imps.
And you're right, she's not trying to return to heaven, right? She's trying to get back into the underworld.
The underworld, yeah.
Yeah, but the underworld, like, that is very much like that Greco-Roman thing of the underworld being a bad place. Like, that's not necessarily the case in every culture.
Yeah, the underworld
it's just a different realm.
Yeah, it can be considered heaven in some places. Like, it's just the other side of death.
Do you have any final words?
Death is only the beginning.
So before we start to look at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or you can email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam, I, and a fantastic team of writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com.
Yeah, and speaking of ecologyforthemasses.com, and very aptly for this Spanish language movie, we will soon be having another international collaborator for Ecology for the Masses, Dr. Mariana Villalba, who is a doctor, an ecologist originally from Mexico, who is currently working on a postdoc at Jyväskylä in Finland. And she will be contributing a monthly piece, doing article breakdowns in Spanish for our Spanish-speaking audience. She also has a podcast called Explain Me.
We'll put the link in the description.
She also has a podcast in Spanish, doing what Sam and I do on the website, where we try to break down scientific papers or explain science in non-scientific terms to non-scientific experts.
Okay, so to start off today, we thought we'd talk about, kind of the most iconic villain, I feel, from this movie.
Mitch McConnell.
Who was the Pale Man. Yeah.
Dave, when he first steps out in the summertime.
Yeah.
The Pale Man is a very tall, very thin, hairless, saggy-skinned monstrosity that has eyeballs in his hands and likes to eat little children.
Yeah, it's not even like, doesn't he just have like the eyes resting on the table and he's got like sockets in his hands that
he does. It's on his plate.
And it puts them into his palms.
Yeah.
Now, Dave, you had some thoughts about why having hands on your eyes. No, eyes in your hands. I mean, both are bad, obviously, but why having eyes in your hands?
I just pictured little hands like coming out of your eyeballs.
Yeah, coming out of the eyes.
Yeah, thank you.
Come here and let me feel
let
you,
me grab
my dear.
You.
So, brief biology lesson, just going back to obviously topics that we've discussed before. Eyes work on the principle that light enters through the front part of the eye, is concentrated through the lens onto the back part of the eye, the retina. That image is then captured by a series of photoreceptors, little neurons that are designed to pick up light, that then end up transferring that through the optic nerve back up to the brain where visual processing takes place, the visual cortex, where we get images. Mm. It's a super cool, amazing system. It is delicate as fuck, and the eyes are not exactly a strong structure. My partner, and I'm sure most of you guys share the aversion as well, any one of those films where you see like a needle passing through the eye or they have to do like one of those scenes.
I can't. That's the one thing in film I cannot do is eyeball stuff.
I find it insanely satisfying.
My God, of course you do.
Yeah. That scene in Brightburn when she's like, picking the glass out of her, I was like, oh yeah, get it out of there.
Nope.
Yeah. Sorry.
So the eyes in the film, you guys, rewatching it, he's got them sitting on the table in front of him, and then he takes them and he plops them into his hands. So there's a couple of problems with this right off the bat. The first of which is your eyeballs need oxygen. Now, the outside part of your eye, the cornea, the basically the windshield of the eye, the surface that kind of protects it and protects all the gooey structures on the inside, it has the ability, because you can't have blood vessels in your eyes. You can't have a blood supply of little vessels that's running directly to the eye itself. So you can't actually have blood on the outside part. Otherwise, you couldn't see. It would just be a network of blood vessels. So the cornea has evolved features by which it takes oxygen from the surrounding environments. It's one of the things they have to consider with contact lenses in terms of making them permeable, because you don't want to shut off oxygen. And in fact, oxygen is decreased and the cornea can survive, but it's reduced when you sleep. So when your eyelids are closed, you're actually shutting off some of the oxygen to the outside part of your eye. Now, The eye also gets oxygen from the first sort of fluid-filled layer, what's called the aqueous humor, the part sort of directly below the cornea, that, again, outside surface. And that is basically through diffusion as well. It pulls from the blood vessels. Now, obviously, listening to this, it would be like, oh, well, the eye can survive totally fine if it's just sitting on a table because it's getting oxygen. But no, the outside part of the eye can get oxygen from the surrounding environment. The inside part of the eye, not so much. All the structures at the back, the retina, the choroid, like all of those areas, they need their own blood supply. The retina has a huge blood supply. And it's actually one of the major problems that's associated with ocular diseases. If they break down and lose the blood supply to the retina detaches, and that oftentimes leads to blindness and secondary glaucoma.
Fun.
Yeah. So eyeballs on your table, not great from a blood supply perspective.
Also, like, we blink all the time. We blink to clean our eyes, and it's just like they're just collecting dust.
And they'll dry out. I mean,
well, yeah, the eyeballs are the only thing I think on the human body, correct me if I'm wrong, that don't have a filtration system. You know, like our nose has hairs, our throat, like everything is designed to filter out germs. But that's why people are so cognizant of saying, like, don't touch your eyeballs, because it just goes straight in.
Yeah, no, tears are actually... Well, tears are really complicated. They're made up of a bunch of different substances, and they actually have antibacterial properties. Your eyes have mechanisms, and that's the whole point. Libby's completely right. The eyelashes, the eyelids, there are all kinds of systems in place to protect the eyes and try to keep crap out of them, but they're a very easily damaged surface, and humans really like their eyes. Now, putting them back into your hand also creates a problem. The optic nerve, the part that basically connects off the back of the eye, is also delicate as fuck. It does not like to be disturbed. Exactly. And in fact, you run into problems in veterinary medicine. We have to be really careful in situations where eyeballs need to be removed, a process called enucleation. You have to be very careful not to pull too much on the optic nerve when you're removing the eyeball, or you'll blind the other eye. It's a very gentle system.
Cool.
So having it so that you can pop it in and pop it out, I really don't see any mechanism where the biological systems are going to be able to reconnect and then establish visual processing, which is complicated. And then
I'm not going to lie, I knew this conversation was going to be tough for me, but I'm like legit squirming. Like when you're talking about tugging on the nerve, like, I can't do it.
How about that scene in Kill Bill where Daryl Hannah stuck?
And then the last point against having eyeballs in your hands is twofold. One, everybody makes fun of dogs and other animals that it's a pretty stupid system to keep all of your really important stuff in the same thing that you interact with, right? Your mouth is constantly coming in contact with everything. That's how you check the world. But it's also the part that contains your ears, your eyes, your brain. But there's a reason we do that, right? You're trying to keep your, again, the optic nerve is delicate. You're trying to keep it as close to the brain and the processing area as possible and keep it up in a protected area. Sticking your eyeballs on your hands, the part that you pull things in with, interact things with, try to collect things with. So either this thing is going to have a really long optic nerve that runs all the way up its arm into its brain, which is just dangerous, right? If it takes any trauma along its arms that it interacts with the world, it can go blind in a whole bunch of different ways.
Also very unlikely to have evolved in the first place, right? Just because of how risky that is, and it would be heavily selected against.
Right. You want them close to the brain. Or two, it's going to have little mini brains inside of the arms, which makes no sense, that are going to be then communicating back to the primary brain.
Like an oot.
Like an oot.
Or like a squid.
I was thinking, because Adam has something really interesting for the pale man as well, but I was just thinking now, like, maybe people are saying, yeah, but what about all those, you know, creatures who have, like, eyes on, well, not fake eyes, on different parts of their body as, like, you know, a warning to predators. That's exactly it, though. Normally, those things are as, you know, like, to put off predators or to warn something else. This is a vicious predator, the pale man, so I don't think he would need that sort of
thing. No, and they're clearly not fake eyes because he's holding them up to try and see. Like, he's blind before he pops those back in whatever,
Yeah, but maybe, you know, he's got other sensory organs. And, I mean, it's a lot more energy efficient to just, you know, have some fake eyes than actual eyes, right?
Yeah.
I mean...
Adam, you had some thoughts, though, on, like, his feeding habits, right?
Yeah, I do. And I think this also plays into the fake eyes argument that Sam just made, because the pale man doesn't have eyes, and he's very pale, which is pretty indicative of a species that lives in a cave. So him not having real eyes, and either these being like an intimidation thing, or maybe it's some kind of olfactory bit where he can, they just look like eyes, but it's actually some kind of smelling or sensing organ in the tip of his hands or in his palms, kind of like a, on the sides of a hammerhead shark's head. The reason a hammerhead shark has such a wide head is because it has a lot of nerve endings out there, and they can pick up electromagnetic pulses from fish that are hiding under the sand. And it's really cool, kind of like a metal detector going over the sand at the beach. But yeah, I think the Pale Man being in a cave, evolving from a cave species, makes a lot of sense because he is very saggy, has that distended belly, and is sitting very still. So a slow metabolism because he has to not expend a lot of energy because there's not a lot of food available, at least food that he will be able to consume and live off of in a cave. And much like a deep sea fish or any other kind of deep sea organism, he's all stomach and needs to be able to eat as much as possible whenever he's able to find food. So I think the Pale Man is a cave-dwelling species that doesn't move very much, ambush predator type deal, and he has those long, grabby fingers so he can just hold on to everything he grabs and consume all of it. And by doing that, being able to fill up his stomach or stomachs, depending on however much he has, having that really loose skin will allow him to just absolutely gorge himself like those fish.
Yeah.
Or like a gerbil or a rodent, you see stuffing its cheek pouches with seeds for later. This is him just stuffing his entire body for later and to be able to live off of one meal for a very long time.
His whole body is a cheek pouch.
Yep. Like a snake. Having a big bolus just kind of hanging out in his body.
Speaking of like, burrowing or cave-dwelling species, the skin really reminds me of a naked mole rat.
One of the coolest animals ever.
Insane. Yeah, they're like resistant to so many forms of disease. I think cancer
as well.
They can't
get cancer.
Like, yeah, it's incredible. They're amazing species.
And they're
useful. Please look them up. Look up the true facts videos, actually, about the naked mole rat, because it's fantastic. Yeah.
Here are true facts about the naked mole rat. The naked mole rat is neither a mole nor a rat, but it is a large subterranean rodent, and it is naked, like pretty much every other animal is. No reason to put that in the name. It would be much stranger if it was born with clothing on, like a little pair of jeans and a tiara.
The only last point that I was going to bring up, and it actually fits in really well with Adam's point, was it looks like he's hibernating. There's clearly long periods of time in between his meals, and so the sort of loose skin, if he's emaciated or he's using up his fat resources in between, that basically he does gorge whenever he comes upon the children that he traps with the weird food. Yeah, that would make sense then, that he's entered into a hibernation state until he's awoken.
I was about to say, is it safe to say that the Pale Man is a carnivore then?
Oh yeah.
Well, otherwise you would think he'd be eating some of that food on the table.
Yeah.
You would think, but I think that might just be a thing of leaning into the fantasy aspect, and maybe Ophelia is kind of putting her colorful kid's imagination on this, but much like a spider, the Pale Man has his spread laid out, and he doesn't get her until she touches it. So you imagine a fly buzzing by a spider on a web. It doesn't reach out and grab it. It waits for it to get trapped in the web, and then it rushes over and injects its venom and then drinks the body. But that doesn't quite work because she's like standing away from the table and he gets up to come after her. But I'm imagining some kind of system where he lays out a trap to entice potential prey items to come by. They get trapped, be it eating the food or not being able to move, and he comes and gets him.
He has his hands on the table when he's sitting there, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's something with, like, he's very sensitive to, like, the weight of the table. So when she removes the two grapes, he's able to actually feel that in his hypersensitive.
Oh, the vibrations?
Mm-hmm, hands. The vibrations or just even, the distribution. Interesting factoid is that he wrote the Pale Man as an allegory for the Catholic Church because he hates the Catholic Church. Very much.
Yeah.
So he designed it to have basically this elaborate spread, and the Catholic Church is only feeding on kids, like the souls of people.
Yeah.
And having all this opulence around.
You're making things up again, Arnold.
No conscience.
You're taking the holy word and adding fiction. Be careful how you proceed, Arnold, when you fear there's a prize.
Bullshit.
Anyway, moving on to the toad. Speaking of underground organisms now, my favorite line of all our notes this week was Adam just writing, "This is literally just a toad." And it's a bit bigger. It's been upsized a bit.
Or Ophelia is really small.
Yeah.
Have you seen a bullfrog? Yeah. They're pretty fucking big.
African bullfrogs are insanely big, yeah.
But this thing kind of looks like a horned toad. Like, it's got the little wings on its eyes.
Yeah.
The big moment that takes place, the one that stuck out to me with the toad, is that Ophelia manages to convince it to eat those three rocks that she's been told she needs to get into the toad, causing it to have this very violent reaction where its seeming everything is tossed out because it just leaves a bag of skin behind. And this sort of yellowy foam material that she digs through to find the first key, completing her first mission, defeating the toad that's feeding on the tree.
Adam, you were saying, because I really want to hear Dave talk about exploding animals, frogs and toads do evert their stomachs sometimes, right?
Yeah, they're able to. I don't know if this is a strategy they use to get rid of food that's bad for them, or if they try to use it to pre-digest something, but some amphibians can straight up vomit up their stomach inside out from their mouths, much like the toad starts to do in the movie. And I think that this could be a really bad reaction to him eating something toxic. And obviously it wouldn't be as full-blown as it is in the movie, but maybe he just went, the toad went just a little bit too far, everted his stomach too much, couldn't get it back in, and it just died with it out.
Yeah. So there are quite a few organisms that do, you know, throw their bits of innards out, like sea cucumbers. Very different organism, obviously. But they will expel their intestine as like a defense mechanism to, you know, confuse and ward off our predators.
It's gnarly.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to be out on the Great Barrier Reef a couple of years back, and you see like sea cucumbers, and then, you know, they'll have like a string of something behind them, and you can see this stringing stuff all around because they get freaked out when people are there, and these are like hotspots for, you know, people diving on the reef. So yeah, sea cucumber intestines all over the place.
Starfish do it too.
Do they?
Starfish actually use that as a predation strategy, where they will crack open either a mussel, a clam, or an oyster, even just a millimeter, and they will stuff their stomach inside and digest the muscle from the inside out, and then pull their stomach back in.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Jesus, that's inventive. Yeah. I'll give them that. That's also horrifying, but fucking inventive. Yeah. Dave, exploding animals.
Animals that explode. There's obviously a lot of myths about it. I definitely, as a kid, was freaked out about rice involving pigeons at weddings and other things like that. For the record, rice will trigger gastric indigestion in many animals, but it's not going to cause pigeons to explode. Unlike what I was told by friends through public school. So,
same. Or your parents or media, like everyone told you that if you throw pigeons, that you don't throw rice at weddings anymore because it made pigeons explode.
Now, mechanisms that are allowing for, you know, explosions or destruction to take place, really interesting. It does seem to be something I stumbled on in the insect kingdom. So several species of ants, particularly there's a group that's found in Southeast Asia, can cause themselves to explode to protect their nest from intruders. So there is a species of carpenter ant that has the ability to basically trigger self-destruction. There's two oversized poison-filled mandibular glands that run the entire length of the ant's body. And when during combat, when it takes a turn for the worst, the ant's been defeated and is probably going to lose, like a limb's been removed or something along that. The ant can violently contract its abdominal muscles and rupture and spray poison in all directions.
The predator strategy. You lose and you just blow yourself and everyone else around you up.
Yeah. Toads, just as like a random side note of, I don't know how I stumbled onto this information, but since it's going into Germany, I thought it was a fun dig around. So in 2005, there were a number of news reports that came out and eventually ended up being observed by actual nature protection officials, in which these toads were seen to swell up with glasses, explode, and propel their organs distances up to 1 meter. So since this had basically been shown and documented, and they couldn't exactly ignore this as just people coming up with weird shit, they had to go in and start looking for it. Now, the media ran with this, and they ended up referring to the area's lake, the home of the toads, as, I can't pronounce it in German,
Tümpel des Todes.
The pool of death. And so basically they found that these incidents as well were occurring between certain dates. And they ended up having at least 1,000 toads that died in this manner over a series of days. So a group of conservationist scientists ended up coming in, including a veterinarian, Frank Mutschmann, who collected toad corpses and ended up performing necropsies. Now, his theory, which I'm going to give here as to what caused these toads to explode, is just a theory. He has a lot of evidence to support it. The media has very widely established, like, answer found. We now know what's going on. They haven't yet, but this veterinarian, while observing the bodies, ended up finding that there were signs of crow attacks that were present on these toads. And basically, they had wounds that were in almost the exact same location. And when he was checking out the bodies, he found out that almost all of the toads were missing their livers. So what the strategy that he ended up coming up with and what he thinks is going on is these groups of crows basically were flying down and they got really good at quickly reaching in and grabbing the liver out of these toads. Now, toads don't have a true diaphragm, which is the muscle that basically separates your chest, your thorax from your abdomen and keeps your lungs in check when they're sort of expanding. It plays big roles in allowing you to breathe. So with the absence of this liver, these toads would then puff themselves up as a defensive move after the crow had grabbed their liver. The expansion would continue as the lungs would continue to expand because there wasn't anything to stop it. And eventually they would pop.
Poor toads.
The poor toads. Currently, the resting theory that this group of toads, basically, crows who really wanted toad liver, were basically like swooping in toad and just pate. Being like, yeah, and grabbing it and then causing them to explode. And apparently got really good at doing it really quickly. And I enjoyed that apparently both of the species have certain degrees of love and protection within Hamburg. And there was a big discussion about, like, should they be protecting the toads? Should they be protecting the crows? Was there going to be retribution from, like, fans of one group against the other, which got, like, a big group of conservationists involved and was just a ton of fun to read. In terms of a theory, because we're Cinematic Animalia and we want to try and make this work, I think Adam's come up with a better strategy than in terms of what I was thinking about. I think that if this thing has a mechanism under which certain circumstances, it either averts its stomach or tries to move its contents out to try and get rid of toxins, or potentially, and less likely, in some sort of predatory move, that these stones, whatever the compound is that basically she's introduced into its digestive system, have stuck. And they've started to expand. They're generating some type of gas or other compound that's reacting. And it's basically taking this natural mechanism that this toad has, and it's causing it to explode and basically puff its material out, similar to what we saw with those poor toads that got their livers whipped out, theoretically. It's just if you take a natural system and you break a step of it, you can sometimes make it do weird things. I mean, that is how many of our poisons work when it comes to our interactions with wildlife.
Another Germany anecdote real quick, especially involving Hamburg and poor dead animals. Like Sam was saying, we got our master's at the University of Bremen, that's where we met. But Hamburg is about an hour away on the train from Bremen. And the first time I went there, I was walking around the beautiful, you know, market district looking at, I think it might have actually been the Altona district where these toad explosions were happening. And I was walking through the market and I just saw on the ground in the middle of this plaza, two pigeon wings connected by a thin bit of gristle and muscle, just right in the middle, no pigeon around, just wings. And then I saw a couple more of them when I was in the city. And from my understanding, it is a species of raptor, a predatory hawk, or a falcon that will catch these birds, rip their wings off, and then eat them at their leisure. And you just see wings sitting in the plaza.
Horrible bastards.
It was like something out of a cartoon. It's like, this, what? Like someone literally just took these wings and just pulled them off.
And right now, we are all in very real danger.
Danger? Ha! I walk on the wild side. I laugh in the face of danger.
Okay, so I think Dave, you also wanted to touch on the mandrake, right? Because, I mean, these are really cool plants. They have a history of being used in kind of, they have a lot of spiritual connotations for a lot of different groups and cultures and that sort of thing. And they have a history of being used in alternative medicine is the only real word for it.
I mean, I was just going to say Harry Potter, so you did better than me.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah, they're in Harry Potter, yeah.
Obviously, mandrakes are just a root of a plant that in some cases bear certain resemblance to humans in common literature and potentially depending on how it's shaped.
Very ugly humans.
So babies.
Right. So since their root often resembles human figures, it has been associated with a number of different superstitious and most commonly medical practices. They've been used for substitutes for a whole bunch of different weird crap. Now, Obviously, there is not a medical component that's associated with the mandrake root, but in the film, the Fawn ends up presenting Ophelia with a mandrake root that she ends up placing underneath her mother's bed during the sickness that's following her pregnancy and is supposed to help to make her feel better. Now, the mandrake starts to do its work. Her mother does get better, but the mandrake is discovered.
Yeah.
And then as a sort of show of faith to her new husband, as well as this big speech in which her mother proclaims magic isn't real, she takes the mandrake, throwing it into the flame. It quickly ignites, and her mother falls ill again. So, organisms, and this is one that I'm going to lean on Adam here because I think he's going to get excited. We do use some natural processes, compounds, and organisms for medical reasons. And the two biggest ones that I'm going to talk about briefly, just because I think that they're fucking cool, are going to be maggots and leeches.
Yeet.
Yeah.
As the kids say.
Right. So if I am damaged, I go through a surgical process, there's some sort of infection that's taking place, and there's been trauma to the affected skin, the surgeons are really bad with their big clumsy monkey hands at going in and trying to remove all of that affected dead tissue, right? It's just, it's really hard to get all the little bits out to get the dead stuff while still allowing the clean new stuff to continue to live. And so
imagine the poor soldier's leg in the cave who is clearly rotting and probably has gangrene. So you're trying to get all of that while leaving the rest of the intact leg.
Right. So we have started using a certain types of maggots that basically are, they end up eating the dead tissue while leaving healthy tissue alone. They also consume bacteria, and some of the compounds they release, there's actually some suggestion, although this has definitely not been proven, that it promotes healing. So medical maggots have become a thing. In certain cases where we find that there's tissue that is not healing the way that we want it to, and we want to try and get that dead material out so that we can allow the proper tissue to heal back in, and we don't want to go for big surgical resections, maggot therapy has become the new big thing. They are classified as drugs because that is their mechanism of healing, falls within biological principles. They are produced in very isolated facilities where they are done in a sterile manner. After they are removed from the patient, they are not reused. They are dipped in an anesthetic solution and then burned like traditional medical waste. Now, and there's been some new research that shows that it can save 40 to 50% of limbs with non-healing wounds. And they have shown in a couple of areas it's more effective than something called hydrogel therapy in debriding wounds. So it's become quite popular. It is not the traditional, I'm eating these maggots or I found this natural substance and I'm making it do. This is a very specific usage of a biological organism to do something in a beneficial manner for humans. Now, the mechanism that I'm probably going to use more for what the mandrake is doing in this film is the leech. So during skin reattachment operations. So let's say that Sam gets drunk one night and chops a finger off and has to go in and have his finger reattached.
Not outside of the realm of possibility.
So during this process, when everything's reattached, what can sometimes happen is that you've got all those tiny little blood vessels that you're trying to sort of realign. And if they're not quite connected in quite the right manner, you can get something called venous congestion. You're getting a buildup of blood in sort of an area that you don't want it to be. So basically these thin-walled veins in those microsurgical procedures are unable to carry the appropriate amount of blood away from the surgical site. Instead, the blood pools in the veins and it's unable to flow back to the heart and lungs to be reoxygenated. And if that congestion is left untreated, carbon dioxide starts to build up in those decaying tissues, will accumulate in the stagnant blood, and ultimately cause localized tissue death, which, as you can imagine, is not fantastic in situations where we're trying to get the limb to stay reattached or we're trying to get that skin graft to stay reattached.
Unless you're going for that zombie look.
Yes.
And you really want just some, like, necrotized, rotten flesh hanging off you.
Yes. People love when their surgeries don't go the way that they want it to. So in recent years, leech therapy has become a positive for these types of rare surgical complications, where if the surgeon is worried that Sam has undergone venous congestion with that reattached finger, they can think about attaching a leech. The leech saliva contains Herodin, so it's an anticoagulant and it's an antiplatelet agent that basically prevents blood clots. It reduces the amount of congested blood in the tissues, and there's other chemicals that basically help to keep blood flowing to the damaged area and sort of reestablish it. And then as a real bonus, which is cool, leeches have a natural anesthetic or numbing agent that's basically present in their saliva to try and stop organisms from realizing they're there. So it's not like it's a painful process. Mm. Now, again, these are approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. It was back in 2004. They are approved in Canada as well for these types of procedures. They are produced in a very specific farm. They are sanitized before each patient. And again, they are burned and destroyed after the process is completed.
I can attest to having leeches on me before. You really cannot feel them.
Okay.
You do not know that they are on you at all.
Cool.
There's a...
And even when you rip them off, like, it doesn't hurt. You're just like, oh, I guess I'm just bleeding everywhere now.
Yeah. There's a really good book. I can go pull off my bookshelf right now and tell you the author, but it's called Dark Banquet, and it's all about organisms that feed on blood, and there's a whole segment on leeches, and kind of like Dave was saying, they use them in these medical practices. And I'm sorry if I'm jumping the gun on you, Dave, but actually, from what the book is saying, they tend to still use the leeches because the human-made drugs that try to replicate the anticoagulant yep. and the anesthetic still aren't as good as what the leeches have.
100%.
Also, I would imagine that it's pretty localized, right?
Like, it's very localized.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's not moderated. We take our normal organs for granted. Your liver and kidney is amazing. And humans talk about these things of like, oh, well, I can just go get dialysis if my kidneys fail. That is a ineffective, not great mechanism as opposed to these cool little organs that you carry around that are just like, don't worry. And whenever you hear humans and they're like, I'm going through a detoxifying cleanse. And it's like, no, you've got a liver and kidneys. Just let them do them. So I think that our mandrake is going to fall more into the leech category. I think this is an organism that's actually attaching to the mother. They may just not actually see it when it's connected to her, but she's out enough and she's got like a limb hanging off the bed at some point. This thing could just be basically connecting itself on. So don't get me wrong. It's still probably pulling from her. Now, I tried looking into if Del Toro, and correct me if I'm wrong, has ever said what the mom is supposed to be sick with.
I don't know. I'm assuming just a really difficult pregnancy.
Like sick of all the patriarchal bullshit around her.
Got it.
Right. So if this leech or organism, the mandrake that's biting onto her, is doing one of three things. Either one, it's isolating and pulling out something that's triggering a greater degree of toxicity, not in any big role, but say mercury. So heavy metals become bound within the body and are really hard. If there's something that's filtering outside, it might be accumulating these as basically a biological sponge. Two, it's producing or secreting something. So if it is releasing compounds that are acting as an antipyrexic to basically bring her fever down, sometimes in situations where humans are undergoing really bad pregnancy, we give them medications to just bring the fever down because their body's just not doing what it's supposed to be doing. And that will help to break the fever. It can make them feel more comfortable. It can help with pain and it can get things going in the right direction. Or the last two features would be if this leech is releasing, the mandrake is releasing some sort of compound that's either helping to stop blood clots, if she's getting some sort of clotting system that's involved here, because if she's throwing a bunch of blood clots, she's basically having microstrokes. That could totally explain what she's going through, if she's hypercoagulable right now. Or if it's in a situation where it's releasing some compound that you are right is stimulating immune system activity, either in a mild antibiotic sense or in some situation that's helping with standard processes. That could totally work. Now, burning it, I don't really have a great mechanism for why it would immediately trigger her to get sick again.
Well, she's probably just, you know, overexerted herself. I mean, she's pregnant. She's gotten out of the bed. She's like, you know, screaming at the daughter and is probably not going through a very good time either way.
The most preposterous option is they whip this thing on and it burns and it aerosolizes whatever compound it removed. But if that was the case, everybody in the room would get sick and she wouldn't instantaneously fall over. I think it's more likely exactly what Sam said. If this thing has been connected to her and it's been helping by, I think the easiest mechanism is she's going through a pregnancy that's triggering a hypercoagulable state. She's just been throwing a ton of clots and she just feels absolute garbage. And this has released compounds that are bringing down her fever and it's helping to stop that clotting from taking place. She feels better, but once the organism is disconnected, her natural systems that it was fighting start to go back. She overexerts herself and she just puts herself back into the boat that she was going to be in regardless. The same way that like if I've connected you with some sort of antibiotic solution and I suddenly pull it out halfway through and Sam's like, no, I'm not done.
Going to crash pretty hard.
And so I do think there could be a mechanism where this organism attaching could be helping with a simple procedure. Whether or not it's going to lead to long-term recovery, I don't know, but it definitely could be making her feel better.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't.
Now, for me, the funny thing about fairies has always been that humans are very much what's called kind of a K species as opposed to an R species. K species are generally a little bit bigger. They invest more care in a very small number of young children.
Yeah.
Right? Longer gestation periods takes us longer to give birth, that sort of thing. Whereas if you go down to the other scale, an R species, generally much smaller species give birth to lots of young. With the idea that, you know, at least one of them will survive.
Providing no parental care at all.
And humans and every other primate are very much a K-selected species. We invest in our young to a great extent. However, if you're fucking tiny, if you are a tiny little humanoid, as most fairies have been, depicted, you need a way, if you are going to be a K-selected species, you need some serious, like, protections. Like, you really need to be... Because when you're that size, there is a lot of shit that can eat you. And I don't think humans, even that are that big... I mean, you know, we did evolve to be the way that we are because of, you know, working together as a team. But I think that advantage kind of disappears when you're this big.
Yes.
So either you need to... Yeah, I think they're going to need to be an R-selected species. So, Libby, the question I want to ask you is, what is the most horrifying way you can think of a humanoid creature that size giving birth? You have a humanoid, right?
Okay.
How do you make it give birth to, like, 100 babies at a time?
Hundreds. Not just a hundred. Hundreds. Like an insect. Like a spider sack of eggs.
I have no idea.
I mean, they have to be laying eggs. That's the only way you can have any offspring.
Yeah, but we're humans, right? I mean, if we're saying that they're just like a closely related to us, like at the very least a primate.
But are they, though?
Yeah, because they're insects in the beginning of the movie, though.
Yeah, that's a stick insect.
I know. I mean, more like traditional.
Yeah, traditional. All I'm thinking is just like absolute madness just spraying out. I can't get that spawned. Image.
like a pig shooting out piglets.
Yeah. Like a machine gun.
If you've never seen it, pigs literally shoot out their piglets like a gun. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, the idea of, like, tiny fairies just shooting out
hundreds of babies. Okay, yeah.
I do have a theory. What if the fairies are actually the young of the fawn? Would that work?
No. The body plans are too different. You'd have to have its knee joints completely reverse and, like, evert.
But they've shown that the fairy is, like, shape change in it. So, like, is, like, that stage of growing up, like, they go from, like, an insect to, like, this humanoid figure. Maybe, like, in its final form, they get even more distorted.
It's a really big size differential.
It is.
But, I mean, they could be, juvenile versions. And that is kind of a fun idea, because we have lots of species that swim and then fly later in their life. Do we have many species that fly in a juvenile stage
lose their and wings?
Lose the ability to?
I mean, it's not flying, but a lot of cnidarians, so the species like jellyfish and coral, you'll have a larval stage that is very motile, so it's swimming through the water, and then it becomes sessile. It anchors itself and never moves again for the rest of its life.
Okay, yeah. Because that would be interesting if you had, like, a juvenile thing that could get around and fly to escape from predators, and then, when it gets a bit bigger and doesn't so much need that escape ability, it can, lose
wings. You see something similar in the species I worked with for my PhD, so the host parasite system, which is odonates, dragonflies, and damselflies, and their parasites, which are these Aeroneurus water mites. They don't fly themselves, but they are they're good parasites in the sense that they get what they need from their hosts, but they're not really costly parasites. The damselflies and dragonflies just kind of deal with them. And then in ecology, we say they tolerate them versus resist them.
Hmm.
But the idea is that they're not doing it to try to parasitize the hosts and really get it, because they're only parasites as juveniles. They're predators as adults. So the idea is that they use these hosts as a dispersal mechanism. They latch on to this host. They can fly, and in the case of dragonflies, fly very long distances, relatively speaking, and in some cases, actually long distances. They go from the pond they were born in to another pond or another body of water. They drop off, they turn into adults, and they can mate and continue the life cycle. So being able to disperse as juveniles really makes sense and is a pretty good strategy.
Yeah. Make my way back home. So, would we recommend this movie?
100%.
100,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Visually beautiful, auditorily beautiful.
Story's great.
Yeah, fantastic acting.
Don't show it to your kids because it's horrifying, but...
There is a fun fact with Guillermo del Toro. When he screened this movie, he was sitting next to Stephen King, and Stephen King squirmed when he saw The Pale Man. He was very proud of that.
That's great. That's really good.
Next week, we're going to come back for a tour de force of ignorance from myself and Libby, who have never read an Animorphs book in our life. And we are going to ask, we're just going to put Dave and Adam under the grill and, find out what the fuck the Animorphs are.
Absolutely.
Adam, do you want to sign us off?
Absolutely. The monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The legend speaks of the lost soul of a princess from another world who will one day be reborn. There will be signs that mark her return. There will be secrets that reveal her destiny.